Members and presenters, I'm going to try and get this thing started. We're getting closer and closer to, I shouldn't insult my Senate colleagues, but we have a history of being a little bit more on time, and we're getting away from that. So, I want to welcome you all here today for this joint hearing with the Energy Policy and Finance Division and the Bioscience and Emerging Technologies Committee. I'm sure everyone realizes that in 2007 we passed some of the strongest renewable energy standards in the country, and we need to look at all of our options, and we have to reduce our carbon footprint in this state and in this nation, and we can't do. Coal's going to be tougher and tougher to do, and nuclear is one of the options that we have in front of us. It is a contentious issue, and we need to start a conversation about what works and doesn't work in it. I appreciate the experts that have come in, many from different parts of the country, to testify today and to share their information and their knowledge with us. And I hope we can begin that dialogue here. We have a very aggressive agenda this morning. I think there's five or six testifiers. I am fearful that we will not have a lot of time for questions, so I instructed staff this morning to put together a sheet. So if you have questions and we don't have time at the end of the hearing, make sure you write them down, and we'll get them to the testifiers, and we'll put it together in a booklet or whatever. Make sure everyone gets all the questions and the answers. By hopefully get that taken care of middle of next week, Friday at the latest. I'd like to remind all the members that the House members have session at 11, so we're all fast walkers, so at about 5 minutes to 11, either Representative Hilty or myself will be gaveling this thing to a close so that we can get to session on time. With that, if I can call the meeting to order and ask that Dr. Dean Abramson come to the witness table and share his remarks with us. Good morning. Welcome, Dr. Abramson.
I want to thank Chairman Hilty for inviting me to appear here today. Some of you may remember that I used to come over here fairly often, but in recent years I have various reasons. And also Chairman Mahoney and members of the committee. I'm going to try to put this into a little bit of a context, some history, and try to frame the issue that you have before you. I understand that there's no legislative, there are no bills pending, and this is an informational hearing, and I suspect that given the... Is that okay?
Dr. Abramson, if I could just for a quick second, could you close those inside doors so that there's less noise coming from the hallway?
Okay. Is it loud enough? I suspect that over the next few years there's going to be a series of hearings of this nature. This issue is not going to go away. Some of you may know that I've been very involved with nuclear power for a long time. My first job after leaving graduate school in physics was as a reactor physicist with one of the major manufacturers of Babcock and Wilcox. They no longer are in the reactor business, but they were one of the four major manufacturers at the beginning of the commercialization of nuclear power. I left there after a couple of years, not because I had any problems with nuclear power, but they were located in a small town in rural Virginia, Lynchburg, and it wasn't, from a social standpoint, it wasn't all that comfortable for a Minnesota boy with liberal tendencies. And so I left and took a job. I was senior research scientist at Honeywell for a number of years, where I worked on things like trying to find submarines that didn't want to be found and that kind of monkey business. I left there after a few years and went back to school and got my PhD and also finished my medical degree and joined the faculty at the medical school. My first tenured appointment at the university was in medicine. In the 70s, when environmental, oh, by the way, Earth Day for next week or something like that, environmental things were very high on the agenda at that time, as they are now, and the university started an environmental studies program. It was in the Institute of Technology, and I was asked to head that. So I switched from medical school to IT, where I had a courtesy appointment in physics. And after a while, I left that and was chairman of a university-wide environmental studies program, and then I went to the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs, where I spent the remaining years before I retired. I started and ran the Energy and Environmental Studies program there at the university for many years, and taught energy policy. I continued teaching some of my students. Some of my former students are here today. I continued teaching for a number of years after I formally retired. But I still teach energy policy at two Swedish universities, Lund University and Chalmers. I've done on a part-time, intermittent basis for many years. Nuclear attempts were made, and nuclear power went from the laboratory to the community. In the mid to late 60s, the first commercial reactor was sold in 1965, as I recall, maybe 63, 65. And it was you can't imagine a technology that had more vigorous support. It had massive public subsidies. It was encouraged at all levels of government and industry. It was the space program of the equivalent of the space program of the time. It was vigorously marketed. It was going to be too cheap to meter. It was safe. It was clean, etc. And many utilities bought in, including Northern States Power, now Xcel. And I got back into it because of the Monticello reactor. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency was formed by the legislature in 1967, and its first major permit application was to discharge so-called industrial waste from the Monticello nuclear power plant. The MPCA somehow found out that I had designed reactors and I'd been to medical school, and so I was an expert, and they asked me to look at routine emissions of radioactive waste from reactors in normal operation, not accidents. The accident issue has never been contentious in Minnesota. And I did that. Your faculty members do that. Legislature or agency asks you, do what you can. And I thought it would be a few weekends' work, and it turned out I spent the next 16 years on it virtually full time. But to make a long story short, I showed, and it was subsequently demonstrated elsewhere, that the emissions of radioactive material, the routine radioactive pollution, from these plants was very much higher, the releases, than we were led to believe. And those emissions high, quite high, were permitted by the Atomic Energy Commission regulation. But it caught the attention of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the governor at that time, Harold Levander, and the state embarked on a process to set its own standards for exposure to radiation. And basically, they asked NSP what will the emissions be, and they gave them a number or some numbers. And the PCA said, okay, fine, let's set the standard there. There was really just outrage from the industry. The PCA, State of Minnesota, was taken to court in both federal and state court. In state court, charged with that the standards were, proposed standards, were arbitrary and capricious. In federal court, the argument was that the Federal Atomic Energy Act preempted regulation of radiological matters to the Atomic Energy Commission, and the state had no authority. That took a while. That went through federal court, and finally was a ruling in favor of plaintiff, in this case was NSP, that the state, in fact, had no authority. But during the process, about 20 other states joined with Minnesota. There was a substantial, very vigorous public discussion, and the AEC, with the Atomic Energy Commission, was forced to tighten its standards essentially to those that had been proposed by the state of Minnesota. Minnesota stood proud in that issue. There have been two other cases where Minnesota was instrumental in safeguarding health and safety from nuclear power. The first reactor here was built at Elk River. I don't know how many of you remember that. It was built in 1963. It was a small demonstration reactor operated by the Atomic Energy Commission. It was never intended to run very long. There were about 15 of those of various kinds built around the country, each of them designed to demonstrate some technical aspects of reactors. And the effort, of course, was to sort out those which could be commercialized. Well, when the permit was being negotiated, the state of Minnesota required that when the reactor reached the end of its operating life, that it be totally decommissioned and the state and the site returned to its original condition. The Atomic Energy Commission agreed to that, but when the time came, the AEC balked and said, no, we don't do this. We'll just leave this pile of radioactive material, or the reactor itself, certain components of it, become radioactive waste during operation. And that led to a ruckus, hearings before the Senate, before the Federal Congress, etc. And ultimately, the state prevailed. And the Elk River reactor is still the largest reactor that has ever been completely decommissioned decontaminated and decommissioned. It sets a great precedent, and that precedent should be tested again. Number of reactors now, a fairly large number, are reaching the end of their operating life. And what's going to do with them? Are they going to sit there for 100 years as requiring maintenance and so forth until the radioactivity decays a lot? Or are they going to be decontaminated and removed? That issue really hasn't yet been decided. But again, Minnesota took the lead on that. There were some other examples as well. And I'm sure you know, by the late 70s, it was abundantly clear that there was a major problem with managing radioactive waste. The first attempt to find a repository was initiated by the AEC. It was going to be an assault mine in Lyons, Kansas. And when outsiders looked at that, in particular the Kansas Geological Survey, I mean William Hamilton, it was found, as he described it, it was like a lump of Swiss cheese. And that was, as soon as the analysis became clear, that was abandoned. That was the first attempt to establish a high-level waste repository in this country. And there wasn't another, well, there were attempts to find sites, but there wasn't another attempt until the effort that's going on now to put high-level radioactive waste adjacent to the Nevada test site where in Yucca Mountain in Nevada. Whether or not that's ever going to operate is really questionable. My own view is that it will not, and the reason is because of contamination to groundwater, long-term exposure to radiation. But we don't know yet. The story isn't done. But the U.S. is not alone in that, in that there is no operating high-level radioactive waste repository anyplace in the world. The argument one sometimes hears is that, well, it's the NIMBY problem. People don't want it in their backyard. That's true. People don't want it in their backyard. But that doesn't explain why countries where public opinion isn't taken all that seriously don't have any. I mean, there's none anyplace else either. And it's just an extremely difficult technical issue as how to contain the high-level radioactive waste from reactors for on the order of a couple hundred thousand years. We don't know how to do that. And by the late mid-70s, it was also clear that the cost estimates initially were optimistic is not really, doesn't really capture it. I mean, they bore little relation to reality. The number of jobs created were not as had been advertised. And so, and then Three Mile Island came. The Three Mile Island reactor had a very serious accident. The core completely melted. Luckily, the containment held, and there was very little off-site radioactive contamination. But that showed, I mean, that kind of accident was regarded as not credible. That was the language. These are not credible accidents that the fuel would melt. Well, it was credible. It happened. And that essentially put the nail in the coffin for U.S. atomic energy, civilian atomic energy. Although it was largely economics played a very, very, very major part in that. But now, and by the way, in the early 80s, I stopped working almost essentially full-time on nuclear power, began to look at climate change and renewable energy, which I did a couple books and so forth, and on the greenhouse effect and climate change. One reason I did that was because it was clear, even in 1980, that the nuclear issue was going to return, that the climate change issue was sufficiently serious so that it would force a re-examination of nuclear power. And I wanted to be in a position where I knew something about climate change and knew something about renewable energy and other non-carbon carbon energy sources. And I don't have to tell you, Minnesota is much, much involved, as is virtually everyone else except the White House, in dealing with climate change. My view, and that of most of my colleagues, is that climate change is the most serious issue faced by society now. It is an extremely serious issue. Basically, it means that emissions of greenhouse gases, the most important of which is carbon dioxide, have to be dramatically reduced to stabilize climate and avoid what could be. I don't use the word catastrophic very often. I don't like fancy adjectives, but it should be used here. And the goal now, in many places, as a first step, is to reduce emissions by half or 60%, some say 80% by 2050, and essentially eliminate carbon from the atmosphere, or from emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, by the end of this century. It's going to be a tough job. It is an enormously challenging job. Well, there are several ways to do that. To reduce demand by using energy more efficiently, can reduce demand by eliminating just pure waste. Simple example, leaving lights on all night when there's nobody in using the space. I mean, that's crazy. It doesn't cost anything to fix that one. You can switch from coal to other lower carbon fuels, primarily natural gas. That's a step in the right direction. But natural gas, like oil, is also scarce. It's not as scarce as oil, but the peak production of natural gas. So the U.S. is already importing substantial quantities of natural gas. That's going to increase. And there's maybe another decade before gas is in the same state as oil is now. You can capture carbon from coal. That is, one can either process the coal and separate the carbon from the hydrogen before it's burned, store the carbon and burn the hydrogen, and then store the carbon someplace. Carbon capture and storage is the rubric that goes with it. Or one can scrub the carbon dioxide from the exhaust stream. If coal is going to have a future as the primary energy source, it can only be with carbon capture and storage. It is simply releasing carbon as a business as usual way is simply not sustainable, and it's simply not acceptable. And this has to happen, again, a major, major challenge. Technically, economically, finding a place to put it, where it'll stay, and so forth. Or can produce electricity from renewable primary energy sources. Here, primarily wind and solar. Minnesota doesn't have great hydro potential within the state, but the opportunity, the potential for wind and solar is large, huge in fact. Or replacing coal-fired plants by nuclear power plants. And that's why we're here today. Or at least that's why I think we're here today. There is now support from the governor and others to set the stage for building new nuclear power plants in Minnesota. The question, of course, is whether, well, here, I'll quote, in the governor's recommendation to the legislature in February, includes this, the policy being proposed, would be intended to assure that utilities undertake analyses of their systems to identify and pursue cost-effective opportunities to reduce greenhouse gas emissions with an emphasis on nuclear power. Now, I don't know why there should be an emphasis on nuclear power, but he stuck it in there. And his director of energy security, Ed Garvey, elaborated a little bit. Building any large electrical generation facility is a lengthy process, which is true, measuring years, actually probably decades in this case. All this proposal does is to remove the moratorium, Minnesota's moratorium language on nuclear power. If someone wants to make a proposal to build a nuke, you can have a discussion, and we will consider whether it's wise and appropriate way to proceed. And I think that frames it. That is, is it cost-effective, and is it wise and appropriate? Not everybody approaches nuclear power from the same way. Some look at it as strictly a routine economic matter. That is to look at the internalized cost. There's a little economics jargon, but internalized costs are those that appear on the books of the firm or the household that's engaged in the enterprise. And see what comes out. It may or may not be substance. But energy is unique in a way, almost unique, in that the external costs are greater than the internalized costs. External costs are those that are not, do not appear on the books of the firm that's involved. They don't, in this case, do not appear in the computation for the price of electricity, but rather are borne by society as a whole. These costs can be very large. I don't have to elaborate on the external costs associated with reliance on petroleum, which are immense. And those costs should be reflected in the price of gasoline, but they aren't. Those are external costs. There are similarly large external costs associated with nuclear power. And many of us consider these external costs to be extremely important, and in fact, the dominant terms in deciding whether or not nuclear power is acceptable as a large-scale energy source. There are others, of course, who also look at nuclear as an ethical issue. That is, do we have a ethical right to burden future generations with the legacy of high-level radioactive waste, which lasts not forever, but a couple hundred thousand years, long enough so that it's longer than political and economic timescales. So what do we do? Nuclear power has huge external costs. Their major ones are the risk of a large accident with really spread radioactive material around the environment. Hard to deal with, extremely difficult to deal with. The probability of such events is small. The consequences of such events are huge, or can be huge, depends on where the reactor is and what direction the wind is blowing at the time. We don't know exactly what the risk is of a major accident that releases substantial amounts of radioactivity into the neighborhood. Modern design, well-operated reactors, it's probably on the order of 10 to the minus 6. That is one event of this kind per 100,000 reactor years. That's a fairly low risk. If you've only got a few reactors, the U.S. now has, I'm not sure exactly the number, I think 104, 103 licensed reactors. There's somewhat less than 400 in the world. But if nuclear, excuse me.
Dr. Abramson, just so we're on a fairly tight schedule, so
I've been watching my clock.
Okay.
Thank you. It's clear that accident frequency of that size would be acceptable if there are thousands of reactors instead of just a few hundred. We're told that paper analyses improve safety by another order of magnitude. And we don't know that. Those are paper analyses of reactor designs that have been known for a long time. The second one is the waste issue, which I touched on very briefly. We don't have any place to put this radioactive waste. It's piling up reactor sites around the country. And finally is the issue of nuclear weapons proliferation, which is not a strictly Minnesota issue, but it's inherent to the legitimization of large-scale nuclear power to combat greenhouse effect. Looking at the options, my students learn, I have two ways of talking. One is 5 minutes and the other is 2 hours. And there's not much in between. But I sometimes can get kind of carried away. But the long and short of it is that of these issues, the issues that were in the aggregate caused an end to the boom of nuclear power in the late 70s and 80s, are still with us. The safety problem is much better than it was. There is no question that present reactors are safer than those of 20 years ago. No question, 25 years ago, no question about that. The waste problem is still unresolved. And we don't know what to do with that legacy of waste. And the proliferation problem is probably worse. I wouldn't say it. It's probably no worse than it was in the 70s and 80s. It's just more evident. It's more obvious with the case of Iran, North Korea, etc. It's interesting to note that the government, the federal government, in each of these cases has assumed the cost. The Price-Anderson Act, amendment to the Atomic Energy Act, limits the liability to the reactor operator or builder in the case of major accidents, a major subsidy. The federal government has always assumed the responsibility for sequestration of the high-level waste and, of course, of the proliferation problem. Those are huge subsidies to this industry. And I just want to end with two brief quotes. One is the role of nuclear power in reducing greenhouse gases. 5 minutes. Nuclear power is negligible greenhouse gas emissions. The major advantage, in fact, the only advantage of nuclear power is that it avoids the problems of fossil fuels. It completely avoids the problem, and that's a major issue. Not only conventional pollution from heavy metals, particulates, etc., particularly from coal, they just aren't there with nuclear power. That is a significant advantage, but it's the only one. Some consider another advantage its inherent complexity and high tech. I mean, there are those who really, if you've got a choice of something simple or something complicated, they'll accomplish the same end, they'll choose the complicated one, just because it's more exciting. I sometimes say that to be a professor of nuclear engineering at the university is something you put on your card, but to be professor of biogas, I mean, it just doesn't have the same ring to it as it does. But if we were going to stabilize, if we're going to follow the projections that are being suggested by the nuclear industry, it would require 3,000 or 4,000 reactors, new reactors, by mid-century, and so forth. It is huge. And also on the economics, and I'll close with this, I want to quote a prominent resource economist who was at Resources for the Future and then at the University of New Mexico. He's no longer active. It is my belief that benefit-cost analysis cannot answer the most important policy questions associated with the desirability of a large-scale fission-based economy. To expect it to do so is to ask it to bear a burden it cannot sustain. That is so because these questions are of a deep ethical character. And that's what it comes down to. That is, it's not conventional economics. It's a new ballgame. It's a totally different situation. I just want to mention in passing that nuclear power is the only primary energy technology that absolutely demands the strong hand of government. It demands regulation on safety things, on waste things, and on the proliferation things. Those cannot be dealt with by the market. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will take any questions that you might have. I noticed that the chairman volunteered our time for who knows how long to provide written answers to questions we get. But now that income tax time is over, I guess we've got a little free time on our hands. But anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Abramson, and I appreciate you coming in today. In preparation for this, I've read a number of your papers and some of the others that are testifying today. For a pipe fitter, it's interesting reading. Members, I've seen...
Depressing reading.
Oh, no, it is not depressing reading.
This is an issue that... The oil scarcity issue, the peak oil question, and this one, these are issues that you really don't want to know about. You're happy if you don't realize that they're real.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Members, I have seen other members from the other body come in and other members of the House come in. There are chairs at the table here. Please feel free. Because of time constraints, I said earlier we're going to pass around and I'll have Autumn pass these around right now so you can remember some of your questions and write them down, and I will make sure that not just Dr. Abrams but all of the five or six presenters get a copy of these, and they can answer them as they like, and we'll make sure that all members here, and I'll make it available to both bodies if they would like, and they can answer them hopefully by next week or shortly thereafter. So with that, I'll ask the next testifier to come down, Richard Rister, and he's a program manager of Nuclear Power 2010, U.S. Department of Energy. And with that, if Autumn would pass it around so we can make sure that, I don't know about anyone else, but I seem to forget questions if they get too far beyond where I am. So, Mr. Rister, thank you for joining us today, and please identify yourself for the tape when you're ready and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me here today. My name is Richard Rister, and I'm the program manager for the Nuclear Power 2010 program at the Department of Energy. And the purpose of that program is to reduce the barriers to new plant construction. We don't really make a decision to build a plant. We're not sponsoring the construction of new plants, but we're just trying to look at the barriers that exist to new construction and reduce those. This morning I'll discuss the status of the existing plants in the United States and touch on around the world, and the outlook for new construction. And why people are looking at new construction now when for many years there wasn't much interest in new nuclear construction, and what the federal government role is in that process. There's 104 operating plants in the United States. 48 of those plants have received an extension of their license for 20 years. The standard license for a new construction is 40 years, and about half have received a 20-year extension. There's 15 plants currently being reviewed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for license extension, and 23 plants have announced plans. I think I heard in this state one plant was just announced for submitting an extension, so maybe it's 24 now. For the operating plant, there's really nothing I've heard that would indicate that any of the plants right now are considering not applying for a life extension. The new construction, there's been a little bit of new construction in the United States, even though you don't hear about it. The Tennessee Valley Authority recently restarted Browns Ferry Unit 1 after a 22-year shutdown. I guess that's not new construction, but it was basically the restart of a plant that had been shut down for a number of years. And then Wattsport Unit 2, they just announced they're completing the construction. That was a plant that was started construction many years ago, mothballs, and now they're going to complete that plant. And the plants that are operating now are operating very efficiently, over 90% capacity factor. Capacity factor is the ratio of how much energy the plant actually produces in a year or over some period of time compared to what it theoretically could produce if it operated at 100% all the time. So now the nuclear plants are very high capacity factors. In fact, last year was close to 92%. There are some of the plants are undergoing power uprates, and what that is it's increasing the amount of electricity that the plant can produce. So if it's a 1,000 megawatt plant, it might, with some modifications to the plant and with some additional safety analysis, they can sometimes increase the power output to say 1,100 megawatts. So that's an increase of production even though you haven't built a new plant. They're also looking at barriers to operating plants greater than 60 years. There's some material issues and other things that need to be looked at, but right now there's no definitive reasons why a plant couldn't operate longer than 60 years. Looking at where we sit in the world, you can see the United States has the largest number of reactors. Like I said, a little over 100 reactors. But in terms of the percent of electricity that's produced, France is the highest at almost 90%. And we're somewhat further down the list at around 20%. Some of those countries on the list are small countries. For example, Armenia has one reactor, and it produces close to half their electricity. There are a number of reactors under construction around the world. In fact, 33 plants are currently under construction. And in the United States, there's a number of plants that are we would describe as in firm consideration for construction. And then there's discussion for a large number of plants, over 200 plants, have some level of planning for new construction. And that's a substantial increase over a few years ago. So there's been a lot of increased construction activity in the nuclear field. Nuclear power plays an important role in the nation's energy production. You can see the plant here. It also is the largest producer of non-emitting electricity. Hydro is the other large piece, but I think hydro, the ability to expand hydro is pretty much, we've built all the hydro plants that you can reasonably build. So there's not a lot of expansion capability in the hydro area. And then the renewables and other make up a small, although increasing, piece of the non-emitting sources of electricity. And this graph expands a little bit on the history of the efficiency or the production of nuclear power. So you can see in the 80s, plants were only operating about 55% of the time, or at least 55% of what their capacity could be. And there was a steady improvement in the late 80s and the 90s up to where it currently is, which is around 90%. By one calculation, it really is equivalent to like building 30 or 35 new plants in terms of the amount of electricity that was produced now from nuclear power compared to what it was in the 80s. A very substantial increase. And electricity from nuclear power is not looking at the capital cost, which is certainly a concern, but if you look at just the marginal production cost of electricity, it's actually cheaper than coal. So the plants that are operating right now are operating very efficiently and are very, at least making their owners a lot of money right now, because for the most part the capital costs have already been included in the cost of the plant to the ratepayers. And another point, the industry really embraced the idea that safety and efficiency go hand in hand. So a safe plant is an efficient plant. It produces electricity. It makes money for their owners. And so safety is really improved over what it was back when the Three Mile Island accident happened. And so these graphs kind of reiterate what I was describing. So you can see that the number of plants actually peaked at 112 around 1990 and has dropped a little bit down to 104. This was the very first plants that were built were really of an experimental nature, and those early plants have been decommissioned. And some of those plants, the sites, one in Michigan comes to mind, but they've been referring to greenfield sites. And I know that decommissioning was one topic that was brought up by the previous presenter. And plants pay into a decommissioning fund while they operate. They're required to do that by law. And so they build up the funds to decommission and decontaminate the plant while they operate. And so that cost is included in the cost of nuclear power. There's a lot of political issues with the waste repository, of course. But there is a repository fund that all the plants pay into as well that is, at least in theory, supposed to pay for the long-term storage of nuclear waste. Now, right now, that money is being used to offset the national debt, but the idea was that it would pay for the amount. You can see from the graph that the total production of electricity from nuclear power has steadily increased. And it's increased because of the efficiency and improvement of the operating plant and from power upgrades. So even though the electricity use in this country has steadily grown, nuclear power has maintained a 20% share. And it maintained that 20% share by improving the efficiency of the operating plants and plants producing more power by uprates. We've pretty much done as much as you can in that area. There's still some uprates occurring, but if electricity continues to, which everybody expects it's going to continue to be used, grow, the only way to maintain a 20% share would be to build new plants. And so this graph illustrates that a little bit. It talks about license renewal of the existing plant, and the dark green, or I'm sorry, dark blue, is the plants that would, the production from plants, if the plants would be decommissioned after 40 years of life. And then the light blue is the existing license renewal, and then the hash mark is if all the plants were renewed for 40-year life. But you can see, for a 60-year life, but if they did stop at 60 years, you can see that the drop in nuclear power production is pretty substantial starting in 2030 and essentially is zero or close to zero by 2050. If we didn't build any plants and those existing plants only operated for 60 years, you can see that it would be a big impact to the electricity production in this country. Every year the Energy Information Administration puts out an annual energy outlook, and they did that for last year, and they project the growth in electricity, and they try to look at economic models and other models, and right now they're projecting about a 300 gigawatt of electricity expansion by 2030. So that's a growth in electricity demand. And if just to maintain, if that were to occur, just to maintain nuclear at its current 20% share, you would have to build 50 gigawatts of new capacity. So it kind of gives you an idea of the scale of the issue. In terms of baseload generation, nuclear is the only baseload power producer that doesn't emit greenhouse gases. But the barriers to nuclear power are primarily economic. There are very high capital cost projects, and the utilities, the power companies that would build a new plant, the value of the company is relatively small compared to the price of a new plant. So essentially they would bet the whole company on building a new plant. So that's one of the barriers to new construction. It's a very high capital cost. Essentially, when you build a nuclear plant, you're paying for all the electricity up front in the capital cost of the new plant. The operating costs are very low because you're not paying all the fuel costs like you do for coal or natural gas. So you're buying it all up front. To get the return on that investment, the plant has to operate for a long period of time, 30 years. It's hard for companies to make that long-term investment when the payoff is down the road. There are some uncertainties in the regulatory process. I'll touch on it in a minute. There's, of course, risk of litigation of trying to build a plant and being stopped by legal action. It's still an economic issue, but it's the economic issue of the first plant. The building of the first plant is always more expensive than the rest of the plants, and so who's going to be willing to pay that first, the cost of the first plant, which is higher than the rest of the plants? So there's a disincentive to be first. So why are people looking at nuclear now? I think people have looked at the performance of the existing plants, seeing that they've been operating safely and very efficiently. There is a growing need for baseload capacity in this country. My understanding is it's not so much in this area of the country, but especially in the south, southeast area. There's a very strong demand for new baseload capacity. And baseload essentially is nuclear, hydro, or coal. Hydro is tapped out. Coal is very difficult to build a coal plant now in any of the states because of concerns over carbon emissions. So what you're left with really is nuclear. Again, there's a growing concern with greenhouse gases. There's concern over energy diversity, so that's why I mentioned the 20%. If you want to maintain nuclear, even at its current 20%, you do have to look at substantial new construction to maintain that diversity. Nuclear is a domestic source of electricity, so it addresses some of the concerns about buying natural gas from foreign countries. And most of the local communities that have nuclear power plants in them are strong supporters of nuclear power. It provides a substantial benefit, economic benefit, to the local community. And so there's typically, in communities that are familiar with nuclear power, have nuclear power in their communities, they're strong supporters. So what's the federal government role right now? The federal government, we looked at the barriers to new construction, and we focused on what we thought was an appropriate federal role, which is the regulatory barriers, some financial barriers, and some technical challenges. And so we developed a roadmap, and we also decided that we didn't want to just finance this all from a federal government perspective. So we said we have to do this on a 50-50 cost share. So the industry has to pay at least half of the cost. of this program. And so we looked at early site permits. Early site permits is an ability to look at a site before you build a plan and to try to determine whether it's a suitable location for a new plan. We worked with industry to develop three early site permits at the Clinton plant in Illinois, North Anna in Virginia, and Grand Gulf in Mississippi. All three of those projects are now completed, and the licenses have been granted. The early site permits have been granted by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We also have two projects related to the developing construction operating licenses. And I'll talk about the licensing process here in a minute. But both of the ones sponsored by the federal government have been submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and are now undergoing review by them. And we're also, in conjunction with those license applications, helping complete the engineering for two advanced reactor designs. The two designs that we're helping sponsor are the Westinghouse AP1000 plant and the General Electric Economic Simplified Boiling Water Reactor. And I think I'll be followed by Adrian Hamer, who's going to talk about the reactor design in more detail. There's also the Energy Policy Act of 2005 included some financial incentives for new nuclear construction. There were three incentives. There's the standby support is an insurance incentive. It basically says that if you build a plant and you do all the things that you're supposed to do in terms of construction of that plant, but for some reason at the end of that process you can't operate the plant, then the federal government will pay the delay cost of not being able to operate the plant. There was a lot of concern over, again, over building a plant and then for some political reasons not being able to operate it. So this is that delay insurance program, and we call it standby support. Two other incentives are the loan guarantee program to offset the high loan cost. A new nuclear construction, because it hasn't happened for a long time, is looked at as a risky investment. And so by the federal government guaranteeing the loan, it improves the capital cost, the cost of financing a new construction. And the other incentive that was included in the Energy Policy Act of 2005 was the production tax credit. All three of these incentives really apply to a small set of first new plants. And again, it's getting over the hump of the first few plants being constructed. They don't last forever. They don't last for all of the plants being built. It's just the first plant to get that first wave completed. I mentioned the licensing process. All the plants that are operating in the United States were licensed under the old process. And the old license, which actually still exists, you could build a new plant under this process now if you wanted to. But the process was to apply for a construction permit. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission would grant that permit and you could build a plant. And then you would have to go back and apply for an operating permit. The NRC would do the review, and if they thought appropriate, grant the operating permit, and then you could operate the plant. The problem with that is that you could have built the plant, and for some reason, in terms of getting the operating permit, you wouldn't be granted, and so you'd have a plant that was built, but now you couldn't operate the plant. And so that capital investment would be thrown out the window. And certainly if you're building a plant on a commercial basis, no company wants to take that risk that they're going to build a plant that they can't operate. So this was recognized many years ago, and Congress passed a new licensing process. And some people call it the one-step licensing process, but it's the process involves applying for a construction and operating license up front. So there's one review, There's one license granted, and as part of that process as well, they have a possibility, it's not required, but there's a possibility of having an early site permit, so you've already done the environmental review of that site and determined that it's a suitable location for a nuclear power plant, and have a certified design. And all the plants being built now are going to be built with certified designs. So these designs have already been reviewed and approved for use in terms of safety from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And it's also created the plants that were built before. They were almost all unique plants. Every plant was a little bit different from every other plant for various reasons. That's not the case today. There's a set of standard designs, and every plant will be built essentially exactly like the standard design, with very few, if any, changes. So, getting back to the one-step license, you get a construction operating license up front before or very near the time that you would begin construction. But you would build a plant, and then at the end of construction or during and at the end of construction, essentially all you would have to do is demonstrate to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that you've built the plant the way you said you would build the plant. And if you've done that, then you, by definition, have an operating license. Then you can operate the plant. There's no hearings. There's no more discussion. If you build the plant the way you were licensed to build the plant, then you can operate the plant. So that eliminates a lot of the risk. However, having said that, nobody is licensed to plant under this process. And so that's why the federal government stepped in and said, we'll help the first couple of utilities go through this licensing process to demonstrate that it can work. And so there's two projects that are going through this process now. Dominion has an ESPWR plant. And we're helping, we helped develop the license application that's been submitted to the NRC and is currently under review. Actually, the slide, I apologize for not updating the slide. It was submitted in the fall last year, so it has been submitted. The other license application is that New Start Energy is a consortium of utilities that got together and said, we're all interested in nuclear power, let's get together and do a sample license application. And so they helped develop, with cost share from the federal government, a license application for actually two plants, one an AP1000 and ESPWR. And so the owner of the Bellefonte site, TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, submitted that license application, and Entergy submitted the license application for Grand Gulf. And so this graphic, actually I got it off the Nuclear Regulatory Commission website, but it gives a snapshot of the status of license applications. And the ones that are in the dark blue, solid dark blue, those are applications that have been submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for review. And I think I counted correctly, there are nine now that have been submitted. And there's a number you can see with the different shading there in later in time that are still planned to be submitted. So there's a wave of applications essentially being submitted to the NRC for construction. No, I should mention, none of these utilities have committed to actually build any of these plants. They're just now going through the licensing process. They have placed orders for some of the large, long-term construction components, the large metal forgings that you require many years of advance planning to build, and so those components have been paid for and are being constructed, but that's a little bit short of actually committing to build a new plant. Georgia Power, which is a subsidiary of the Southern Company, you can see up on top there at the Vogtle site, they actually signed a contract with Westinghouse and engineering, procurement, construction, EPC contract for to construct the Vogtle site. So they've agreed to the terms, they've agreed to the price, but it still has to go through their Public Utility Commission and demonstrate that it's the lowest cost, best option for the state of Georgia. So if they're successful in doing that, their plan is to proceed with building these plants.
Director, if we could just, we're
going to
try and keep on schedule
here. Okay, I'm almost done. And the last slide or two addresses the climate change. The Department of Energy formed a task force to develop a climate change technology strategic plan. And these were experts from all aspects of the energy technology. They involve people that work on renewable energy technology, energy efficiency, coal, nuclear, combined cycle gas turbines, all the technologies, and they try to determine how, if you were going to address climate change, how could you do that? Came up with some different goals, and a couple of the goals are listed here. These are kind of mid-level goals. If you wanted to have the maximum CO2 level at 450 parts per million or 550 parts per million, again, these are kind of the middle-level goals. They're not the highest, the lowest carbon goals or the highest carbon goals. They're kind of the middle. And what this graph is trying to show is what contribution that this group of people think nuclear power would have to play in order to reach these goals. So it's not in isolation. This is with very aggressive renewables, very aggressive coal carbon capture technology, very aggressive energy efficiency implementation. But what portions would nuclear power have to play in order to achieve these carbon goals? And what the graph shows is the dark blue is the current plants that are operating. The medium blue is if we renew plants for 60 years, and the light blue is for the existing plants for 80 years. But you can see that there's still a gap. If we built just the plants that are currently planned, you get the dark green. If you were to build, starting in about 2020, four plants per year, in addition to the current set of plants that are being considered for new construction, can you get to those light green, and then the very lightest green is if you started constructing eight plants per year around 2050. So it kind of gives you an idea of the scale of the problem and how nuclear would play into that scale if you wanted to establish some of these carbon goals. And the last slide really reiterates that point a little bit. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rister. I appreciate you coming in. And again, members, I'm keeping a list of my questions, and I think I've got about 20 for the first two. So please keep those questions there so that we can have all of our testifiers answer these, because we've got a very, very aggressive agenda here today, and I'm going to try and keep people moving along. Our next testifier is Melissa Savage, and she's the Program Director of Environment and Natural Resources from the National Council of State Legislators. And Ms. Savage, welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record, and hopefully we can continue on here.
Okay. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Melissa Savage, and I manage the Environment Natural Resources Program at the National Conference of State Legislatures. I thought to put my remarks in context, I would give you just a brief background on what NCSL is and what we do. We are your membership organization. We are nonprofit, bipartisan, and serve all 50 state legislatures, all legislators, and legislative staff. We provide information to legislators on policy issues ranging from health to children and families, and of course, energy and environmental issues. We have two offices, one in Denver, which is where I'm based, that produces most of our policy research, and our office in D.C., which is there primarily to lobby Congress on behalf of states' rights. In our work in the NTSL Environment and Energy Transportation Program, we serve as a resource to state legislators and legislative staff as they work through some of these issues facing their state. We strive to provide cross-cutting and balanced information through meetings, publications, and presentations. One way we do this is through staffing a high-level waste working group, which is made up of legislators from across the country that are facing issues that we're talking about today. An example of what the high-level waste working group is working on right now is we have, NTSL has a radioactive waste policy, and it's the tool that we use through a D.C. office to lobby Congress and the White House on these issues. Our spring meeting is next week, and the high-level waste working group has worked through some amendments to address one of the issues that I know comes up quite a bit when we're talking about this issue, which is the storage of the waste. The high-level waste working group has a proposal on the table to make an amendment to our policy on this issue, which would create an interim storage, which would, I guess, make it support a volunteer community that might come forward that would like to serve as interim storage site. So that kind of gives you a background on what NTSL is and what we're doing right now on these issues. As fuel prices continue to rise, energy generation and the various sources available continue to dominate discussion not only in the media but also at state houses across the country. As states look to energy options that are clean and reliable, the conversation often turns to nuclear power. Some figures on nuclear energy, which I know we've heard, I don't want to repeat too much, but according to DOE, nuclear is second only to coal in terms of energy production in the United States. And today, as we've heard, over 100 power plants producing about 21% of the electricity generated in the United States. Of course, nuclear energy does not come without debate on a number of topics. Top among those are storage issues and transportation of the waste. A topic of consideration is, of course, safety of the plants and the employees. So today, what I'd like to do is give you just a brief background information on storage issues and transportation issues, kind of where we've come from, where we are today. That will include a little bit of an update on DOE activities, not to duplicate what we've already heard this morning, waste issues, including storage and transportation. And then I'd like to provide just a brief update of some state legislation that we're crafting in 2008 from a couple of other states on this issue. So while this power source is definitely a viable option for many states, the big question is how do we deal with the waste? In 1975, President Ford made the decision to forego reprocessing commercial spent nuclear fuel because of non-proliferation concerns. And an interagency review group was convened and recommended that a geological repository was the way to handle the spent fuel. A national survey at the time identified several rock formations in 17 states that could possibly fit what they were looking for. As a little trivia, in 1981, President Reagan did withdraw the ban on reprocessing fuel. Right now, France is the only country reprocessing or recycling fuel. They reprocess their own waste as well as waste from a handful of other countries. In 1982, Congress passed the Nuclear Waste Policy Act and authorized a waste management system to permanently isolate the spent fuel. The key components of the NWPA included the requirement that the DOE develop a permanent repository and propose a monitored retrievable storage facility. Policy Act also granted the Nuclear Regulatory Commission licensing authority over DOE activities in this area. The permanent repository was limited at the time to 70,000 metric tons of spent fuel. And in order to pay for this waste management system, the Nuclear Waste Policy Act also established the Nuclear Waste Fund. Ratepayers pay into the fund at about 1/10 of a cent per kilowatt hour. Since 1983, that fund has generated $29.9 billion, and about 9.5 has been spent. Money from the fund is appropriated by Congress annually. We are aware that the industry has a strong desire to take that off budget to allow for the fund to be used to create an alternative waste management system. Just a history about how we got to Yucca Mountain. In 1983, 9 potential sites were identified, including Yucca Mountain. In March of 1987, DOE proposed a monitor retrievable storage site at a breeder reactor at the Oak Ridge, Tennessee site. While local community was supportive at the time, the state of Tennessee did sue. And as a result, the Nuclear Waste Policy Act was amended in 1987 and annulled the DOE's Oak Ridge proposal. A little bit more background on the 1987 amendments. The amendments did require a single repository to be used for spent fuel and high-level waste disposal. DOE was directed at the time to study only Yucca Mountain. The selection process for a second repository was postponed. Through the policy amendments, the Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board was created. This is an independent panel that evaluates not only the technology used, but also the scientific validity of the program. The amendments also linked the development of a monitored retrievable storage facility to the siting of a permanent repository and established a January 31, 1998 deadline as a date for DOE to take title of the spent fuel. So I think we're all aware of the current situation with Yucca Mountain. So what's happening right now? Spent fuel storage at nuclear power plants occurs in a couple of ways. We have pool storage and dry cask storage. All fuel removed from reactors is cooled in specially designed pools under at least 20 feet of water. After the spent fuel is cooled, it is placed in sealed metal cylinders with a concrete outer shell and then placed on a concrete pad. This type of storage is in place in 31 sites under general nuclear plant licenses and 15 sites with site-specific licenses. The current status of Yucca Mountain is February of 2002, the Secretary of Energy recommended to the President that Yucca Mountain be the site. In April, the governor of Nevada disapproved that designation. In July of the same year, Congress overrode Nevada's governor. So DOE is moving forward, but I believe we all are aware that this is questionable, as was mentioned earlier, about the future and whether or not Yucca Mountain will ever accept waste. Also thought I would give you some idea of what we're talking about as far as storage and what needs to be stored. There are 120 locations in 39 states currently storing waste. As of the end of 2007, the used fuel in storage was 57,932 MTU. If DOE starts to pick up used fuel in 2017, the liability for failure to perform is about $7 billion. It grows at a rate of $500 billion per year. And this is because DOE is not taking title to the waste as required by the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. The cost of dry storage on a total life cycle is about $150,000 to $200,000 per MTU. So transportation of waste. This happens fairly regularly. Spent fuel and high-level fuel that's destined for storage or disposal at a repository is in a solid form. It can't explode and isn't flammable. There are approximately 3,000 shipments of fuel have traveled across America over the last 4 years without an incident of harmful release. And since 1999, when the 6,000 shipments of true waste, which is transuranic defense waste, has been safely transported to the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, WIP, as it's commonly known, in Carlsbad, New Mexico. As I mentioned earlier, safety, of course, is a plant employees and community members that live around the plant. It's a paramount concern to regulators, operators, and, of course, state legislators, since these are your constituents. Over the last few years, I've taken several tours of power plants across the country, and this, what I can tell you from those personal experiences is that the security, the badging, the symmetry that happens is very significant. And I've been told during my tours that I'm more, my exposure rate is higher living in Colorado and traveling as I do for work. There are safety precautions and systems set up which have been shown to be adequate. Over the years, the National Academies and several other organizations have conducted safety studies, including the risk of radiation and the overall safety of the technology that's used in the plant. Each year, these issues, as I mentioned, are concerns in many states that have power plants located in their state, are in along transportation corridors or proposed transportation corridors. And most of the concern is stems around safety of their constituents. This year, we're tracking about 40 pieces of legislation in about 17 states on nuclear energy issues. There are some that are that require public notification of planned releases. Indiana and Kentucky, and I think this is pretty common, what we see is a lot of states are as looking to the future and how we piece the energy puzzle together, what portion of what we be looking at nuclear in the future. Indiana and Kentucky are through resolutions have established interim study committees on the issue that will take up what the current picture looks like, what the future looks like, kind of what you're doing here, learning about what the future holds. Other states are looking or have bills up for consideration that would repeal this requirement that storage issues be addressed before new plans are proposed. And then there are a few states out there, not Nevada, but a few that are encouraging the Department of Energy to advance on Yucca Mountain. And the future for the reactors, and I know probably be covered by some of the other speakers, but what we know from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that they expect 22 license applications between for the next 5 years. And the states are listed here that they expect to get applications from. And I know you're gathering your questions and you have several generated, I'm sure. I'm speaking to you from my role as Environment Natural Resources Manager, but we also have an Energy Program Director, Kate Mark, who couldn't be here today, but she would be, I'm sure, more than willing. We would both to help you in any way that we can provide clarification or any additional information.
I'm going to take that as a signal that your presentation is complete. Well, thank you, Ms. Savage. I appreciate that. I think you almost get us back on the schedule. I'm going to remind the committee to make sure that you get your questions down, because this could, if you are like me with my 20 questions, this could be quite the booklet come next week or the week after with questions and answers. And I hope we come up with some good questions. I've got a couple here for you that I'll present to you later on. Thank you. And our next presenter is Adrian Heimer, Senior Director of New Plant Development and Nuclear Energy Institute. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Mahoney and Chairman Hilty. I'd like to thank you for inviting me on behalf of NEI to chat to you today about nuclear designs, what the current status is on new nuclear designs, and where we're going. It's especially gratifying for me to come to this part of the country, the upper Midwest, which I think typifies the best that America has to offer in the rest of the world. And there's a tinge of sentiment there because Minneapolis was my port of entry, just in case some of you hadn't recognized by now that I actually originated from someplace east of Cape Cod. So, thank you. A little bit about the Nuclear Energy Institute. We are a Washington, D.C. Industry Association representing the nuclear companies in Washington, D.C. We have 300 members, U.S. and international, made up of utilities, generating companies, nuclear designers, architects, engineers and constructors, manufacturers and suppliers, universities and the unions, law firms and consultants. Our main members are the U.S. nuclear generators, and we have numerous advisory committees, and about 1,800 personnel from the industry serve on a variety of industry working groups and task forces, both interacting from a technical as well as a policy perspective. There are four main functions. One, nuclear generation, which interacts with the federal regulatory agencies and other agencies in Washington, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Environmental Protection Agency, FEMA, and the Department of Homeland Security. Government relations, whose primary task is interacting with the Congress in Washington, but also assist and other companies in interacting at the state and local level when invited to do so. We also have a media and communications group that deals with the press, TV, publications, and that's critical in this day and age where sort of you have immediate communications and you have to get on top of it to get at least a perspective out to the public. So that's critical. And finally, we have executive legal information technology and member relations. As you've heard already, there's a number of activities going on as regards the deployment of new nuclear power plants in the United States. Here is a map before you of where those activities are occurring. 17 companies are working on some working on applications for some 30 new reactors. 9 applications have been submitted, license applications have been submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for 15 reactors, and we expect at least 5 to 6 more during this calendar year. 5 designs are under consideration, and I will get to those in a minute. The main need, as you've heard from other speakers today, is that there's a need in this country for low-cost, stable and reliable baseload electricity generation. And the other driving factor is climate change. All these companies that are shown or looking at projects in the United States have conducted fairly intensive economic assessments, taking into account a variety of assumptions, and also taking into account a fairly aggressive form of energy conservation and efficiency program. And have come to the conclusion that nuclear at the moment provides the best option to move forward as regards baseload generation. Getting on to the designs, the new designs that are under consideration really take into account and factor into their design 40 years of operating experience here in the United States and also insights from operations around the globe. They're based on really a set of standards that were put together by the Electric Power Research Institute of Palo Alto in California, which worked with a group of utilities, designers and architect engineers in the early 90s to come up with a general set of specifications to improve the design, to factor in what we learnt during 40 years of operation. specifically, as you would expect, their more stringent design specifications. We've taken into account lessons learned from some of the material degradation that has occurred, so we've improved the material specifications. We've increased safety really by going down two paths. Either increase the number of safety systems and standards, or we've taken a slightly more innovative tack on the use of natural phenomena, using gravity, natural convection and conduction. All these things increase the operational safety margins at the facility. Reliability of the safety systems has been increased by making them simpler, less complex, and these design improvements equate to approximately a 100-fold increase in the level of operational safety going forward. And those numbers are really based on safety assessments and reliability assessments that have been performed using input and data from machinery that's operating today. And if you take improvements in the design of components going forward, that could well increase even further. There will be more automation and less reliance on operators taking immediate action, so the operator can monitor what's going on, see what's going on, and if necessary take action to override it, rather than charging around, making switches, closing breakers and starting and trying to monitor what goes on at the same time. And just like in today's facilities, there will be an on-site simulator, and each operating crew will be rotated through for refresher training every 5 to 6 weeks. Compare that with the airline pilots that go through refresher training every year. So that's the sort of rationale that we're working on to make sure that we maintain our standards of operational performance and safety performance. As you would expect, we've used computers to provide greater accuracy in the design and the design calculations, but also to simulate construction. One of the things you can do with computers these days, I'm sure most of you are aware, is that you can actually simulate the construction process. So you can put the plant together, see what equipment should go where, and that's critical. If you look at the last round of construction projects, although some, like here in Minnesota, came in on time and more or less within the budget, others didn't take 5 years, they took 15 years. Others didn't cost $500 million, they cost $5, $6, $7, $8, $9 billion. And one of the reasons for that is that some of those plants were the design and construct as you go. So you put the pump there, and then halfway through construction you realize the pump shouldn't go there, the switchgear should go there, because you've got to bring another system into this room. And so the construction force who just put the pump in there had to take it out and move it. And there's nothing more disheartening to a craftsman to put something in and then dismantle it again. And that went on, and that, along with other factors, sort of exacerbated some of the problems that resulted in some of the cost overruns and schedule overruns. So 3D simulation can help you overcome that, along with the fact that we're going to have the design completed, or essentially complete, before we start construction. We've learned as we've gone through the years that detailed scheduling, planning, resource management, both in terms of worker management and supply chain, is critical. It's been critical in recent large projects, such as the restart of Browns Ferry Unit 1 down in Tennessee, where they restarted the plant. It was a $1.8 billion project. It had been shut down for a significant period of time. In some areas it was essentially a rebuild, but that came in on time and within the budget estimate. And closer to home here, a Fort Calhoun that had a $400 million material upgrade project came in under budget and 5 days earlier than anticipated. But you can only get there if you have very detailed resource and planning going forward. And even at a level that we didn't even contemplate, never mind in the 70s, in at the turn of the century, 1999 and 2000, and when we've looked at overseas projects and seen the level of planning that they go into, and the level of scheduling, we're going down to that level to make sure that we can build these plants on time, just as they can overseas. Modularization is another factor that we're bringing into the process, which has been proven in the petrochemical industry, where we can, where the sites are located on large navigable rivers or on ocean sites, you're going to build large modules in shipyards, perhaps 1,000 or more tons, ship them to the site and then lift them into position. If it's a landlocked site, such as the site in Virginia, North Anna, 40 miles northwest of Richmond, you're going to see the components brought to the site and then fabricated into modules at the site and then lifted into the facility. You can do that under better control conditions, better environment, which results in improved quality. Obviously, centre to the design is going to be the containment. That will remain. The picture you have in front of you shows the containment for a BWR. The ABWR, which is still going to have the shield building wall, which is 45-inch plus thickness of steel-reinforced concrete, a containment vessel inside of that, and then you get to the dry well, which is 5 foot of reinforced concrete, before you even start getting to the reactor. Obviously, with the reactor, we're going to still have that principle of multiple barriers through fission product release should an event occur, be it in the cladding for the fuel, the reactor coolant pressure boundary, which has been improved for these new designs, and finally the containment structure. Of the five designs that are being considered, three are pressurized water reactors and two are boiling water reactors. Some of these designs are being constructed today overseas, and one of the designs is in operation. We have Areva with its EPR. Areva is a French company, but it's also based here in the United States in Lynchburg, Virginia. It's 1600 megawatt electrical, four loop PWR, and I'll be going into these in a little bit more detail in a minute. Mitsubishi has the largest design at the moment at 1700 megawatts. That was submitted for NRC approval in December, as was Areva's EPR. And then finally on the PWR front, we have the Westinghouse AP1000, which has already been certified, and amendments being issued was submitted in November last year to make further improvements. And on the boiling water reactor side, we have the ABWR, which is in operation in Japan, being constructed in Taiwan, and will be or could be constructed here in the United States at the South Texas project just south of west of Houston. And finally the ESBWR, which is currently under review by the NRC. The picture you have before you is the Areva EPR, which is a 1600 megawatt. To the right, you see the turbine building where it houses the turbine and the generator. In the foreground, just astern of the truck there, you see the control room. You see the containment structure there, and Areva has a double containment structure. So it's built in place. You can see an outline there of the four steam generators. And just at the 9 o'clock position to the east of the containment structure, the facility you see there is the spent fuel for storage, which is partially below grade and surrounded by a substantial amount of reinforced concrete. Four plants will move forward with this design from at least three companies: Constellation Energy, Pennsylvania Power and Light, or PP&L, and Ameren UE in Missouri. And there are two other companies who are actively pursuing the EPR design, but they're not quite as far as long as the other two. If you go to the next slide, you see a breakdown of the EPR design, a little clearer You see the four large components there. This is a four-loop steam generator, so they're the four steam generators. The water comes out of the reactor, which is in the center of the concentric circles, which is the containment, which obviously comes up in a dome over the whole machinery space there. It goes into the reactor, comes out of the reactor, into the main coolant pump, and is then pumped back through the core. The small cylindrical, which are kind of matched to the steam generators, are the accumulators to inject water in the event of emergency until the emergency systems come up to speed and can inject. And you can see the four safety trains surrounding the independent safety trains surrounding the containment. Two of those are bunkered and underground. Any one of those four trains can provide sufficient injection to shut down and cool down the reactor core in the event of emergency or a design basis accident. Two of these designs are under construction, one in Olkiluoto in Finland, the other in Flamanville in France, and China has placed two orders. It is one of the three designs being considered in the United Kingdom for their program going forward, along with what I've described here in the United States. The next design is the Mitsubishi, which is called the APWR, Advanced Pressurized Water Reactor, and it's a 1700 megawatt four loop, so very similar in layout to the Areva design I just showed you. It's slightly different here. It has four safety trains, but you need two of them to safely shut down the plant, so you need two of the four to operate and function to meet the same criteria. It's based on a plant that is under construction in Japan, and the equipment is already under test in Japan. It also incorporates some improvements to the fuel design based on the experience of operating for the last 20 to 30 years. Mitsubishi is the prime Japanese pressurized water designer and manufacturer. And this is the largest, and it's somewhat of a more traditional approach to some of the new designs, but it does have the additional safety features. And it is under review by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we expect probably approval of the Mitsubishi APWR in the 2011 timeframe, and that's also roughly the same timeframe that the EPR will probably be approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. You really want to have the design approved before you get the license and before you start construction. So that's one of the limiting factors going forward, that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is reviewing both some of the design and the licenses at the same time. But by and large, they will not issue a license to construct and operate until the design has been approved, and that's what you would expect. And finally, we get to the AP1000 on the pressurized water reactor design, which uses some more innovative techniques, somewhat smaller design than the EPR and the APWR, at the around about 1175 megawatts electrical. The picture you have in front of you, and I recognize members of the public can't see it too well, but in your handout, it gives a legend of where the equipment is. Again, to the right hand side, sort of a typical layout, you have the turbine building housing the generator and the feed water heaters and the turbine itself. And then you go into containment and you notice it's a slightly different structure and shape, we'll get to that in a few minutes. This design was certified in 2006. They submitted an amendment to further improve the design last year, and we expect that amendment to be approved in the 2011 timeframe. One of the features of this design as we go forward, just as I go back, You see, the structure on the left is the containment structure. You see the refueling crane at the top there, just beneath the donut type of the structure, which is a large cooling water tank. And we get to that function. And underneath of it, you see the two steam generators. This is a two-loop pressurized water reactor, not a four-loop. And the steam generators are very similar in configuration and design, but better material properties than what's actually in place today and operating in Europe and in Arizona, in the Palo Verde station in Arizona. One of the functions of the AP1000, it simplified the design and moved a lot of the safety systems through natural convection and conduction within the containment structure. And so if you look at the left-hand side and you see the number of pumps and valves and backup safety diesel generators, all which need to function to inject water, and you see the number of penetrations that go through the containment area, and compare that with what's on the right, where everything's confined within the containment area and it's still the same size. That helps with the maintaining the integrity of the containment pressure boundary. And you can do that by incorporating a natural convection and conduction. And the design also, not only does it sort of simplify things, but it's also got the pressurizer is larger. It's a third larger than what is typically found in pressurized water reactors today. And that helps to increase the plant's ability to withstand large power transients without causing too much stress, both on the operating systems and the operators. The piping systems in this design have been reduced in length, and the number of welds has been reduced by as much as 65%. So, I mean, those are some of the features that have been improved. And now get to the natural circulation part. What you see here in the center is the reactor, and just to the left you've got the steam generator, just to the left of that you have the pressurizer with a third tank suppression pool make-up pool to the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, the oval and the circular, small circular structures are the accumulators. Should you have an event where you need to maintain cooling, water from the storage tank there and also another tank just above the accumulator, which is on the right hand side, maintain the cooling by natural conduction and convection. Hot water rises, goes into the tank, is cooled by a heat exchanger in the tank. Cold water then drops back down into the reactor core. Fairly simple, fairly straightforward, well proven in other designs which aren't necessarily commercial, but well known. If you have a pipe break, the accumulators inject water into the core while it depressurizes, and then you get drain down of the cooling of the makeup tank to flood the reactor. The steam comes out of the piping or whatever is broken and goes up into the containment where it forms steam up there. On the outside, coming down from the donut-type feature at the top, it's cooling water, which drains down over the top of the steel containment and forms a evaporation film, which conducts the heat away. The water cools down, condenses on the inside, and drains back down to the makeup tank. This has been tested at the quarter scale at Oregon State University and also in Italy. It's been proven to work, and so it is functional. On the outside, you have the BioShield structure, which again is several feet of steel-reinforced concrete. And as with all these designs, part of the upgrade to some of these, we are taking into consideration aircraft impact analysis from wide-bodied commercial airlines crashing into the building and see what the effect is, and ensuring that, one, you can still shut down the plants safely. And one of the things you look at, if you look at this building here, is the fact that does the bioshield bounce into the containment structure there? To date, we can safely say that you can still shut down the plant, even with the impact of a large commercial airliner. Moving on to the boiling water reactor design, this slide in front of you shows the progression of the containment design and evolution from the earlier boiling water reactors through to the ESBWR. When you get to the Mark III containment, which is the plants that are operating in Ohio, the Cleveland plant in Ohio, the Riverbend and Grand Gulf stations in Louisiana and Mississippi, they all, from the dry through to the Mark III, had loops similar to the pressurized water reactor, where you had piping and then you had a pump which forced water through the core to cool the core, which then bubbled up into steam, and steam flowed down the pipe and it came back into the system, having been condensed in the having gone through the turbine. In the ABWR, they eliminated the need for that piping and made the pump integral with the reactor pressure vessel, so reduced the probability of a pipe rupture there and improved the safety of the plant. In the SBWR, which stands for the Simplified Boiling Water Reactor, the ABWR stands for the Advanced Boiling Water Reactor, they went forward and eliminated the pump. The difference between the SBWR and the ESBWR is one with 600 megawatts, that design was suspended. The ESBWR is a 1500 megawatts. Both those designs are based on a design that's operated for many years in the Netherlands, which was a 60 megawatt natural circulating water reactor. And in fact, is that if you have a recirc pump trip in the advanced boiling water reactor, it's part of the safety features of that is you get a high degree of natural circulation. So it is a natural progression to the natural circulation plant, which is the ESBWR. The next slide is a cutaway of the advanced boiling water reactor. This is the GE Hitachi version. A version very similar to this there's an application for a license to construct and operate a similar design, but it's a Toshiba design, as I said, just the southwest of Houston. It doesn't have reactor recirculating system piping. Again, at the top you have the turbine building with the generator. You've got the feed water heaters and hydrogen coolers. As you come to the center of the two boxes, you've got a series of floors there. One is the switchgear room. Internal of that, inside that, you have the control room. And then you get to the reactor building, where you see the 5-foot-thick reinforced drywall containment surrounded by the reactor building, which is several feet of reinforced concrete. One of the things about these plants is it's a lot of equipment, it's a lot of steel, it's a lot of concrete. And there is an issue out there dealing with the supply chain of concrete, steel and components. But it's not nuclear unique. It's unique, doesn't matter whether you're in building a coal-fired generating station, a pipeline for natural gas or petroleum products, or you're building a road. The issue is there. The price of commodities have continued to rise. Aluminum is up over 150%. Copper is more than quadrupled in price since 2003. Steel is 150% increase since 2003. And the driving factor for that is India and China. China's building one power plant a week, one large power plant a week, and most of that is coal. So there's a great opportunity there for US manufacturers to get back into the nuclear supply chain business, and we're not a bastard encouraging them at NEI. But I just thought I'd bring that up as one of the challenges that we face. We've recognised it, and we're taking actions to make sure that we have the equipment in place on time when it's needed to construct these facilities. The next diagram is the ESBWR, and if you can see it, it's a cutaway again with a legend that you can look at in your own time. But if you see what we've got here, which is the advanced boiling water reactor, and then you go to the ESBWR, it's very much simplified. Lot fewer systems, you're relying on natural circulation, you don't have to rely on emergency diesel generators, and so it's the same sort of concept that I described for the pressurized water reactor a few moments ago. It has 25% fewer pumps and valves and motors. It's a much simpler design. The generator and the turbine are laid out in the same configuration. The control room in this instance is underground. There's an alternative shutdown panel 180 degrees around the other side of the dry well containment structure. The spent fuel pool, where it's elevated for the advanced boiling water reactor, here as in the EPR, it is underground, which helps with regards common defence and security issues and storage of the spent fuel. And all these designs have improved severe accident management features, so that if you did get a core melt, and if you did have some severe accident which resulted in a release into containment, you would have the ability to better control that and handle that, which further reduces the potential for any offside release during an emergency. The next slide that you will see is the natural circulation process for the GE Hitachi ESBWR, which sometimes stands for the Economic and Simplified Boiling Water Reactor. You start with water in the core. The control rods come in from the bottom, and you control power and the amount of heat that goes in and out of the core by these control rods. You would start to withdraw the control rods, the water heats up, it turns to steam, it bubbles up in the chimney in steam. It then goes through the steam separators and the dryers to take out the droplets of this saturated steam. It goes down the main steam line, turns the turbine, gets condensed in the condenser under the turbine, and pumped back to the reactor. It comes in, as you see on the right hand side, at the feed water. It runs down the annulus into the bottom of the reactor, comes back up. It's heated up again, boils, and goes out the top. That's fundamentally what it is, but it does require a very tall reactor pressure vessel, and the largest reactor vessels that will be in service when this unit comes online, probably in the 2016-2017 timeframe. These large forgings at the moment are only made in Japan. JSW still works in Japan. However, other countries and other companies have shown an interest, notably in South Korea, United Kingdom and France, about manufacturing large forgings. And again, that's an area that we're encouraging the US manufacturers to get into. The next diagram is just a close-up of the ESBWR. At the top, you see the heat exchangers, which are immersed in tanks, which provide natural cooling to the core, should flow cease for some reason or another, or in the event of an emergency. Again, hot water rises, goes up to the heat exchanger, which is number 3, is cooled, and flows down to the bottom and re-enters the vessel. And so that way, heat rises, cold water sinks. It's a natural process. It's been proven over time. And one of the reasons why these plants are so safe is because it relies on these natural phenomena, like convection, conduction, And if you need to make up, it has the gravity fed cooling tank number 5, which drain down into the core. So even if you have a pipe break, you still end up with 12 feet of water above the core, which enhances the design, and which means that this type of reactor design, along with the AP1000, has a very low probability of having a core damage event, and an even lower probability of having a release into the environment should there be an accident. The next picture you have in your package is just a 3D version of what you've got here, showing the tanks at sort of midnight, 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock. It's not here on the computer because of slight glitch in compatibility between our PowerPoint and this one. So I'll just move to the final slide, which is a little bit of futuristic look ahead. We are also focusing on smaller, safer reactors for deployment in the 2020s. We have several companies, Toshiba, Westinghouse, Pebblebed, Areva, all looking at these smaller designs, which are less than 1,000 megawatts thermal. Compare that with an ESBWR around about 4,500 megawatts thermal. From a generation perspective, these are very small plants, 300 megawatts electric. Probably wouldn't be deployable from an economic perspective in an industrialized country like the United States, but certainly would be deployable if you overcome some of the challenges in some of the emerging world countries that are looking towards having electricity, and this is one of the areas that they could get electricity from. Where it comes into play in the industrialized world, Western Europe, Japan, South Korea, North America, is in process heat for industrial applications. The petrochemical industry is very interested in this, especially when you look at their feedstock, which is in many cases natural gas. Price of natural gas in the year 2000, which was around $2 per million BTU. Today, it's over 9. That has an impact on petroleum products. So it's just not the price of oil, but it's the price of processing. They're looking at alternative heat forms that don't generate greenhouse gas. So they're very interested in this. You can actually manufacture hydrogen from this, and with the Department of Energy through the New Generation Nuclear Plant Project and the Hydrogen Initiative, that is being looked into, both in terms of high temperature electrolysis. We're talking about temperatures here in the 700 to 900 degrees centigrade. And one of the challenges that these reactors have is that they're pushing the frontiers of science and technology. And it also plays in a factor with regards to coal to liquids or gas to liquid type of fuel regime, cine fuels that you could come up with. The problem at the moment with those types of plants is that they generate a huge amount of carbon dioxide. But using nuclear as process heat, you can very much reduce that carbon footprint to almost zero. And finally, from a health perspective, water purification and desalination. Water is becoming a major issue, not just here in the United States, but overseas. And if we can find a way to purify stagnant water and a heat source to do that, which is economical, or even desalination, which a number of people are beginning to look at, that could benefit mankind going forward. I thank you for your time. I went through it at a fast canter, but hopefully it was useful. And I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hammer. Again, I appreciate you coming. I appreciate all of the testifiers coming. And I'm sure we will have some questions. I filled up one more page. So, you'll be getting those. Thank you again.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Members, our next testifier is Byron Wright. Byron White from the Prairie Island Indian Community. And if Byron, Mr. White would come down for.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll only take a few minutes of your time here.
Thank you, Mr. White. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
My name is Byron White. I am the government relations representative for the Prairie Island Indian Communities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. As you may know, the Prairie Island Indian Community is located in southeastern Minnesota along the banks of the Mississippi River, approximately 50 miles from the Twin Cities. Prairie Island is among the closest communities in the whole nation, next to a nuclear power plant and an above-ground nuclear waste storage site. Twin nuclear reactors and 2,000 large cement nuclear waste storage casks sit just 600 yards from our home. The Prairie Island storage site is licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to hold up to 48 casks of high-level radioactive nuclear waste. 29 storage casks are needed to get the plant through the end of its current operating licenses, which expire in 2013 and 2014. If the plant is relicensed for an additional 30 years, a total of 65 casks would be necessary. Each storage cask contains 40% fuel assemblies, which represents approximately 25 tons of nuclear waste. Prairie Island is just one of thousands of communities in 39 different states located near what are supposed to be temporary nuclear waste storage sites. There are presently 121 temporary storage sites scattered across the United States, including two here in Minnesota. More than 169 million Americans live within 75 miles of these temporary storage sites. This includes millions of Minnesotans who live in between the storage sites located in our state at opposite corners of the metro area, with Monticello to the northwest and Prairie Island to the southeast. 25 years after Congress passed the National Nuclear Waste Storage Act and mandated the establishment of an underground repository, the future of the nation's nuclear waste disposal program remains very much in doubt. The proposed spent fuel repository at Nevada's Yucca Mountain has suffered numerous setbacks and may never open. Yucca Mountain opponents have succeeded in diverting needed funding for the project as part of a well-publicized effort to slowly starve the project to death. Officially, Yucca Mountain was scheduled to begin accepting nuclear waste by 2010, but now, if it's licensed at all, the Department of Energy says it won't be open until 2020 or later. Both Democratic presidential candidates have vowed to kill the project. Meanwhile, communities like Prairie Island and Monticello bear the burden of the federal government's inaction. The paramount public safety concerns that first compelled Congress to build an isolated storage facility seem to be fading as the issues slip from the American consciousness and gives way to talk of building new nuclear power plants. Understandably, for most Americans, the nuclear waste issue is not at the top of their mind. It's not an issue that they're exposed to every day. For Prairie Island, the issue is more difficult to escape. Prairie Island community members are reminded of our nation's nuclear waste problem whenever they look out of their living room windows. The talk of building new nuclear power plants is more difficult to forgive. The nuclear power industry, it's been said, is on the verge of a renaissance. Dozens of new nuclear power plants are being proposed throughout the country. That despite the uncertainty surrounding the nation's waste disposal program and no firm answers for how to deal with the waste problem. Permitting the industry to build new nuclear power plants without any regard for a permanent, secure repository for the waste that will be generated removes the only real incentive the industry has for solving the waste problem. The federal government must get serious about solving its nuclear waste disposal problem before allowing the construction of new nuclear power plants anywhere in the United States. Prairie Island believes the federal government must deliver on its promise to move the nation's nuclear waste to a safe, secure facility before it embraces this so-called nuclear power renaissance and turns to nuclear power as a preferred energy source for this country. Until that happens, it is irresponsible for any state, including Minnesota, to entertain building new nuclear power plants. Thank you.
Mr. White, thank you for your comments. I'm going to take just a quick license here to tell the committee and to reiterate on tape what I said to Mr. White in the halls of our body is that if I as a legislator or as a private citizen have anything to say about another nuclear plant, we will not and I will not support the economic racism that is done with some of this plant location. And I've said it in private, and I've said it on tape, and you have my assurances that I'll be standing right next to you on that one.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time, Mr. White. Our next testifier is Mr. Taylor. He's a senior fellow for environmental policy at the Heartland Institute and managing editor of Environmental and Climate News. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity to speak here today.
Thank you. Could you identify yourself for the page and then proceed, please?
Yes, my name is James Taylor. I'm Senior Fellow of Environment Policy at the Heartland Institute. The Heartland Institute is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy organization dedicated to sound science and sound economics. I know that our time is short, so I will retroactively cede some of my time to the prior speakers and keep my comments as brief as possible. As prior speakers have noted, Minnesota energy demand will increase over time, and yet Minnesota's nuclear power generation will eventually disappear unless new nuclear power plants are constructed. The bad news is that this risks substantial disruption of Minnesota's current power supply. The good news is that the safety and efficiency of next-generation nuclear power technology promises benefits above and beyond what we are currently reaping with our existing nuclear technology. Now, prior speakers have mentioned a few of the nuclear reactors that are being proposed right now. I'll focus on one in particular and limit it to that as far as current next-generation technology for purposes of time. That would be the Westinghouse AP1000 that was discussed. And the reason why I will focus on this is, as was mentioned earlier, in Georgia, there is currently a contract between Westinghouse and local power utility to construct the nuclear reactor, assuming that it gets approval from the regulatory agencies, and approval is somewhat promising. A few notes regarding the AP1000 that are pertinent to consider here in Minnesota and elsewhere. In terms of economics and the environment, first of all, the AP1000 offers twice the power with only the same size ecological footprint of current power plants. In other words, it gets twice the power production without any additional ecological encroachment. Moreover, the AP1000 costs less to build and to operate than current reactors. Indeed, a single AP1000 reactor produces the same amount of emissions-free power as 200 square miles of wind turbines. If you think about the ecological footprint of developing 200 square miles of land for wind turbines, compare that to a new AP1000, and you can see what the environmental benefits of this new technology would be. Indeed, not only is modern nuclear technology safe regarding humans, but it is tremendously better for the environment than all other options. Regarding safety of the AP1000, I will summarize this in terms that people can understand. I know we had a very in-depth description of this, but a few brief points are worth reinforcing. First, there are many passive safety mechanisms regarding the AP1000 that make the technology and the reactor inherently more safe than current nuclear technology. Keep in mind, the current nuclear technology and currently operated reactors are extremely safe as is. But some of the advancements, as mentioned, gravity and forces of nature, convection, etc., rather than pumps and motors, are utilized to the greatest extent possible. Although current nuclear reactors have a redundancy and a diversity of safety mechanisms to ensure that a motor failure or some other type of a pipe failure will not lead to any serious safety issue, nevertheless, in theory, I suppose many of these could occur at once, and you can have an issue. But regarding the AP1000, utilizing forces of gravity, forces of nature that don't break down, don't need replacement parts, we minimize the potential safety issues. And to quantify the improvement in safety of this next-generation technology, which, as I mentioned, is available today. It's already been contracted in Georgia. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has certified that AP1000 technology reduces the already minimal risk of core leakage in existing reactor technology by an additional 99%. Indeed, the safety, or shall we say the risks of any type of core damage for the AP1000 are 1/100th that of existing nuclear reactors, which, as I mentioned before, already have a tremendous amount of diverse and redundant safety mechanisms built in. So the AP1000, not only is it environmentally friendly, not only does it offer less expensive nuclear power than we are currently receiving, but safety-wise, the technology is exponentially more advanced than what currently exists. It's an extremely safe option for Minnesota's nuclear future. Now, going beyond what is currently available, I'd like to discuss what will be available very soon.
This would be pebble bed reactor technology. It's currently in development in China, France, Germany, and South Africa. Prototypes are being built. These will be available commercially within a matter of a few short years. And this offers substantial promise for Minnesota and throughout the nation in terms of economy, in terms of the environment, in terms of safety. And I'll highlight a few issues here for the purposes of brevity. I'll keep it short. But in essence, pebble bed reactors, rather than having a large nuclear core, the reactors essentially have numerous self-contained graphite balls, roughly the size of a tennis ball, and they are filled with tiny pebbles of fissible material. These are totally self-contained. The graphite ball is melt-proof. Each one serves as a mini nuclear reactor. Now, there are many benefits, especially safety-wise, for the pebble bed reactors. First of all, it is literally impossible for the temperature inside the ball when fission takes place to melt the graphite shell. It cannot happen. The graphite shell is able to contain whatever that the highest temperature can be generated through fission. The graphite shell is able to contain that, indeed by a factor of two. Next, even if one of those graphite balls were somehow to melt, there would be minuscule radiation leakage from any individual graphite ball. And because the balls are self-contained, there is no chain reaction there that is started, as is the case, theoretically, with a large nuclear core. In other words, all these graphite balls would have to melt simultaneously, and indeed we know that it's impossible. The graphite simply withstands that amount of heat. Next, the pebble bed reactors, they burn far more efficiently. They can burn at higher temperatures, they can utilize more of the uranium or other material than current nuclear technology allows. So not only do we have more efficiency, but we generate much less waste. Also, in terms of waste, the waste can be contained, self-contained within the graphite balls. This is indeed what is foreseen in the future as a means of containing any waste that does occur. We can contain them in their own shell in the graphite ball. As we mentioned before, the graphite shells are extremely difficult to melt and to permeate. Also, the pebble bed reactors, they use inert gas, preferably helium, rather than water as a cooling mechanism. Helium does not absorb the radioactivity. If there were to be any radioactivity released through the graphite balls, the helium would nevertheless prevent it from escaping. Now, current nuclear technology, with all the safety mechanisms understood, nevertheless, in theory, the water that cools the various elements can absorb some of the radioactivity, and that, of course, is where we have to have the various safety mechanisms to make sure that the radioactivity of the water does not escape. With pebble bed reactors, the helium gas does not become radioactive. Also, what's very, very beneficial about pebble bed reactors is that when higher temperatures are achieved, this is exactly the type of scenario that we fear for current technology when temperatures rise too much. But with pebble bed reactors, the more temperatures rise, actually the more that the nuclear processes shut down. It's a self-contained mechanism. If the temperatures from fission rise to a certain degree, then fission becomes less active. So it's contained even within the graphite ball. And finally, to put this in a real-world illustration, German scientists shut down all the coolants and safety mechanisms in their prototype pebble bed reactor and allowed the graphite balls to heat up as much as they would and then observe to see what would happen. Would there be any type of damage, any type of leakage? They found absolutely none. The balls themselves were self-contained even without any of the safety mechanisms that are in place. So that's essentially, in a nutshell, what we have for the future, the pebble bed reactors, which will be available in Minnesota very soon. Far less expensive to build than current nuclear power plants. A physical impossibility that there would be any type of leakage, any type of an accident that would expose residents to radiation. A few comments or a few topics just before I conclude that I think are worth noting. Even with current technology, just last July, there was a magnitude 6.8 earthquake in Japan, right at the site of one of their nuclear reactors. The 6.8 magnitude quake resulted in so little damage that there was absolutely so little damage to the facility itself that the amount of leakage that occurred was less, just a tiny fraction of what citizens are exposed to in a day, in a typical day anyway. In other words, when you have a major earthquake, even right on the site of an existing nuclear power plant, once again, these have proven in the real world to be incredibly safe. Now, to put that in perspective, the technology in place in these reactors today, compared to the technology of the next generation AT-1000, for example, is equivalent to the technology of an old rotary dial telephone versus today's BlackBerry, where we can surf the internet, get our emails, do all sorts of wireless functions. And indeed, the technology that will be in place for pebble bed reactors will be exponentially better than what we have for our BlackBerry, using that same illustration. Regarding cost, well, actually regarding community destruction, it's also important to note that when you add nuclear power plants, you don't need to disrupt the community anew. If we're going to, say, put wind turbines into place, we have to site them. There aren't currently existing wind farms where you just pluck a few turbines down in the middle. You have to clear the land in development. You have community opposition. Nearby residents have understandable concerns. But with nuclear power plants, you are very frequently able to build them on the site of existing power plants, especially with the new technology. There's a minimum of community disruption involved. Also, regarding costs, as I mentioned, the costs of the new technologies are less expensive than existing nuclear technologies. And what's really beneficial about the existing or the future technology is that as other forms of power, as other sources, coal, natural gas, wind, etc., as time goes by, these become more expensive. Whereas nuclear power, particularly with the emerging technologies, nuclear power is becoming less expensive over time. And just a final thought, I really would like to emphasize with the prior testifier, Mr. White, and his testimony. One thing we need to be on the lookout for, however, is that so long as states such as Minnesota have a nuclear moratorium in place, it provides a paradoxical incentive for those who oppose nuclear power to fight what has been studied, what has been commissioned, to fight the central storage facility at Yucca Mountain or elsewhere. Back in the 1980s, Congress was controlled by Democrats, but it was Democratic and Republican agreement that this was in the best interest of the nation. And when states have a moratorium dependent upon the completion of Yucca Mountain or some other central storage facility, those that oppose nuclear power for other reasons then have additional incentive to oppose Yucca Mountain in particular, even though, in a bipartisan manner, we've concluded that construction of a centralized federal waste storage facility is in our national best interest. So I would encourage this legislature to keep that in mind regarding the future of nuclear power, that we do want to work to encourage the construction of what we all know to be a safe future, as opposed to give incentives for others to oppose it. That will conclude my testimony. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I look forward to any questions you may have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor, and hopefully we will get our list of questions to you in the next several days here. I want to thank all of the testifiers here. I'm going to just conclude the hearing today. We actually will be able to make it to session on time. So again, I want to thank all of you that came from Washington and from Denver and places elsewhere. And I want to remind the committee members and anyone else that might have a question, and if they submit them, we will get answers from these members and make sure that all the members get a chance to see them. With that, thank you, members. The committee is adjourned.